I'm going to share with you out of the Gospels tonight. I'm not going to tell you what chapter or what book it is, because if my mom found out you were reading it in this low a light, she'd kill me. So I'm just going to tell it to you, and you can follow along. It's about a man who was born blind. And a condition of blindness like this man had, that was something all of his life that was absolutely hopeless for him, meant that he was in touch with his condition. Nobody had to tell him, hey, you're blind. He knew he was blind. He was born blind. He didn't know anything but blindness. And because of that, he was in a position to say, I could use some help. I need your help. And when he was touched and when he was changed, he knew that he could see. There's a story about a man who went to visit his friend in another city, and while he was there, he noticed this beautiful park in the middle of the town, and he said, that's one of the prettiest downtown parks I've ever seen in any city. His friend said, that used to be the city dump. Years ago, a project went underway to transform this part of the town and make it the metropolitan center. It changed from a dump into a beautiful park. And that's really also the testimony of a person who comes, like John did, or like you did, to know Jesus Christ. And the story goes like this. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Now, some of the Jews at that time actually believed, like some people today, the wrong thinking that suffering is always directly related to some sin. That if you're suffering, it's because there's sin in your life. Inevitably, the reason that you are experiencing such grief is that somewhere along the line, you have displeased God. Otherwise, you wouldn't be suffering as much. Some of the Jews actually believed in the possibility of prenatal sin. That you could sin in the embryonic and the fetal stage of development. And how they come up with that, I really don't quite know, but they believed in it. And some of them mystically thought that because of that sin process prenatally, you could be born in such a condition like this man, blind, or some congenital anomaly. Then there were also some Jews who actually believed in the preexistence of the soul. Because many of them, years before this time, lived in a place called Alexandria, Egypt. And a man by the name of Philo, who was a Jew, believed in the writings of Plato. And since Plato believed in the preexistence of the soul, Philo believed in the preexistence of the soul. And the teaching just spread through the centuries. You know, it's funny. Actually, it's sad. Mark Twain said, lies or falsehood can make it all the way around the world while truth is just lacing up her boots. People will believe all sorts of corny doctrines, errant things, just because they're new and they haven't been taught before. And the disciples were victims of this false teaching. Well, who sinned? This man, or was it his parents that sinned, that the reason this child is born is because God is punishing them? Have you ever heard anybody say something like that? God's punishing me. That's why this has happened to me. Jesus said, that's not the reason. It's not because he sinned or his parents sinned, but instead of going into a big diatribe against what they believed or a reason for sickness in the world, he said, the glory of God is going to be shown. And he quickly said, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. One of the marks of Jesus Christ, as seen in the life of this man and so many others, was his compassion. He knew that he had a short time left. He knew that when he saw human need, as Jesus walked by, he noticed that man was blind. He paid attention to it. And he's moved with compassion. He's going to do something about it. He had already planned to do something about it. Jesus was so full of compassion. When he looked at the multitudes there in Matthew chapter 9, it said he had compassion upon them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. When Jesus went to the tomb of Lazarus and Mary and Martha met him outside that gravesite and they were weeping, it says that Jesus was moved in his spirit, or provoked in his spirit, moved to compassion. It's a hallmark of his ministry with everybody. In the Garden of Gethsemane, they're arresting Jesus. They're about to beat up Jesus. And Jesus quickly says, if I'm the one that you're seeking, then let these disciples go. He's concerned about them. On the cross, while he's bleeding for our sins, he says, John, make sure that you take care of my mother. Behold your mother. Woman, behold your son. In every situation, he was concerned about the needs of somebody else. It's so evident in just the kind of people he hung out with, or the kind of people he would touch. For instance, a leper. It was unlawful to touch a leper. And besides, unlawful or not, nobody wanted to touch a leper. They had oozing sores all over their body. They smelled. And Jesus didn't have to touch him. Jesus could have stood 30 feet away and gone, you're healed. Bye. But Jesus would touch the leper, something that a leper hadn't felt for many, many years because they've been alienated from society. That's the compassion of Jesus. There was a little girl who was sent on an errand by her mother, and she took a lot longer than her mother had anticipated. And so her mother had it in her mind, when that daughter of mine comes home, I'm going to scold her for taking such a long time. Well, the daughter came home eventually. Where have you been? I sent you on an errand hours ago, and I expected you to come home a long time ago. She said, well, Mom, as I was coming home, I saw one of my friends, and she had a broken doll. And the mother said, oh, so you stopped to help fix her doll? She said, no, I stopped to help her cry. Jesus could have managed things a lot differently than he did, but he stopped in the midst of human misery to take note of it and to do something about it, to touch, to say a word, to spend time with. And he saw human suffering as an opportunity to help. He said, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said these things, now what you're about to hear doesn't quite fit, it seems, with what we've just said. He spat on the ground, made clay with the saliva, and put it in the eyes of the blind man. That sounds so gross, doesn't it? I've never seen a faith healer on TV pull that one. I've seen him do a lot of other things. But that would be a new one, wouldn't it? There's another point where Jesus actually looked a guy right in the face and spat right in his eye. There was certainly no method that Jesus had to follow. He spat on the ground, rubbed mud with his saliva, and packed his eyes with that saliva-based mud. And then Jesus said, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and he washed and he came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors who had previously seen that he was blind said, is not this he who sat and begged? Some said, this is he. Others said, he is like him. And he said, I am he. Therefore, they said to him, how were your eyes opened? He answered and said, a man called Jesus made clay, anointed my eyes, and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and I received my sight. And they said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. Jesus, on purpose, wanted everybody to notice what had happened, because he's going to make a very important spiritual principle. So after he put the mud in his eyes, he said, go down to the pool of Siloam. The pool of Siloam, which means sent, as we just read, would be like a main center of the town of Jerusalem. You see, when Jerusalem was first founded, the water source of the city lay outside the city walls at the foot of the valley of Kidron. And the wall was erected, and the only way to get water is to go outside the city wall or to go by the water shaft directly with a huge bucket several meters under the ground. And King Hezekiah decided that he would build a tunnel some 535 yards from the spring to a place, a holding place inside the city walls where people could gather their water. He called it the Pool of Siloam. And since that time, the priests came there for water for the temple sacrifices. The women came there for water for their homes. It was just a gathering point of many people. Jesus put the mud in his eyes, said, go down to the Pool of Siloam. And it's so that people would notice it. Well, they noticed it. And they're starting to talk about it. And not only do the people know about it, but the religious leaders are about to find out about it, and it's going to make them really mad. And Jesus had that in mind as well, because it's all part of the principle he's going to get across. They brought him, who formerly was blind, to the Pharisees. Now it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. And the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to him, he put clay in my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. Then they said to the blind man, what do you say about him? Because he opened your eyes, and you said, he's a prophet. But the Jews did not believe concerning him, for he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered and said, we know that this is our son, and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know, or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He's of age, ask him. He'll speak for himself. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogues. Therefore, his parents said, ask him, he's of age. So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. Now, what was their hang-up? Their hang-up is that they were very, very religious people who didn't know God. Religious people who do not know God can become some of the most obstinate, stubborn, hard-hearted people that walk the earth. There's a lot of them. They're blinded by their tradition. And these people were hung up that it was the Sabbath day. Now, on the Sabbath day, you could do no work. Making clay by any kind of means was considered by these Pharisees work. In fact, the Pharisees said, if you have nails in your sandals, you can't walk with them on the Sabbath because nails constitute a burden and you would be bearing a burden if you walked in those sandals. You see, religion emphasizes the outward. God always looks at the heart. God deals with the heart first, the inside of a man, not the outward. They were so concerned about outward appearances, they neglected the heart. First of all, if I were the man, I might have said, excuse me, Mr. Pharisee, when was the last time you healed anybody? Let alone on or off the Sabbath. And this man brings it out later on. He says, ever since the beginning of time, nobody has opened the eyes of a blind man like him. But they didn't see that. They didn't look at the miracle, the changed life, the open eyes. They were concerned about their petty little stupid Sabbath regulations. That, by the way, was not imposed by God. They added all of those regulations. In fact, the Pharisees said, you can't even give a person medical attention on the Sabbath day. If he has a broken limb, you can't set it on the Sabbath day. Even if you have to break it the next day because the calcium buildup is so big, you let it go. The only time medical intervention is possible on the Sabbath is if that person may die. And all you do is maintain his life. You don't really bring him to a full cure. You just let him stabilize on the Sabbath, cure him the next day. So Jesus did a major no-no, a major healing faux pas. He did it on the Sabbath. Religion adds to the Word of God. Besides emphasizing the outward, it adds rules and regulations that God didn't put in place. How many times we can get stuck in our ways and we do things simply because we've always done it that way. Not because God told us, just because we've always done it. That's our tradition. Don't upset it. But the most damaging thing about what these Pharisees were all about in their religious system is that religion puts up these huge barriers that separates us from one another. Now, churches, denominations, movements often erect walls after a period of time, barriers. And at first, they seem good. They seem like they're protective, inclusive barriers. We're putting up something to keep us in. But the moment you put up a wall to keep certain in, you keep put up a wall to put others out. It excluded people. In the temple, there were courts. The Gentiles, the non-Jews, had their court. It was the biggest court, but it was the furthest away. You move in a little bit closer, and there was the court of the Jewish women. If you were a Jewish woman or a man, you could go to that court. But if you were a Jewish woman, you couldn't go any closer. There was another court that was closer for the men only. The men could go a little closer than the women, and probably they looked over their shoulder, and with that maybe look of pride, they went a little closer. Then there was a court only for the priests. And then beyond that, the high priest could go once a year into the Holy of Holies. These were walls that kept people out. And the New Testament in the book of Ephesians says, all of those walls have been taken down. There's no Jew, Gentile, male, female, Scythian, bond, or free. We're all one in Christ. Here's a man living in fear of these religious leaders whose parents are afraid to answer any questions lest they be kicked out of the synagogue, out of the temple. And so they come to the man. And he answered and he said, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I know. I was blind, now I see. That's a hot testimony. He didn't have all the theological words to tell us what he ought to about who Jesus was at that point. But he knew what happened to him. And his testimony was, I'm not the way I used to be. It's like the woman from the country who couldn't say it quite right. She says, I ain't what I ought to be, and I ain't what I gonna be, but I sure ain't what I used to be. I was blind and now I see. And you know, I like the testimony of simplicity of a man whose life or a woman whose life has been changed by God and they know it than a person who has all the correct theological theory in his mind but doesn't personally know Jesus. Some of us love theories and theology. This man knew that Jesus changed his life. Hey, I don't know all these things you're talking about, but I used to be a blind guy. Now I can see. It's all I needed. Well, they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I told you already. You didn't want to listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become one of his disciples? And they reviled him and said, you are his disciple. We are Moses' disciple. You can just see the pride in that statement. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we don't even know where he's from. And the man answered and said, why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, and yet he's opened my eyes. Now, we know that God doesn't hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard that anyone has opened the eyes of one who is born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered and said to him, "You are completely born in sin, and you are teaching us." And they cast him out. A New Testament phrase for they disfellowshipped, they kicked him out of the temple. They had the right to do that. Not the spiritual right, but they certainly had the caretaker of the proprietorship of the temple. They cast him out. He is now unable to fellowship as a Jew in his own temple. But listen to the next part. Jesus heard that they cast him out, and when he had found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" Isn't that beautiful? Jesus was looking for the man cast out. They kicked him out of the temple, and now the Lord of the temple is seeking him out. The religious system put him out. God looked for him. Man pushes others away. God looks for those people. The cast-offs. He said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would have no sin, but now you say we see, therefore your sin remains." These Pharisees had no sense of need because they had a set of standards that gave them a false security. You see, they made up a religious code and they thought, as long as I keep this code, thou shalt not, thou shalt do this, then I'm okay. Jesus said, "You teach the commandments of men, you say the right things, but your heart is far from me." But as long as they kept this little religious code and they kept all the outward rituals, they felt good about themselves and they had a mutual admiration club for each other. "Well, you're a righteous guy." "Yeah, well, you are too." And in this false sense of security in their religious system, their heart was so far away from God, they didn't even know they had a need. Jesus said, "You are blind as a bat because you say we see." He's contrasting the physically blind who knew that he had a need, was in touch with his blindness. Now he can see, with those who are spiritually blind and they're so blind they don't even know they're blind. They think that they can see. It's like a blind man running around saying, "Yeah, I can see," boom, running into one wall and then another wall. Spiritually, that's what these Pharisees were like. But Jesus is that great divider who came and presented himself rather than the system. We're all growing in grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ. We're growing from glory to glory, but not all of us have the right theological answer. That's okay. Paul said, "We know in whom we have believed." You might not know all what you believe. You're still sorting that through. But the most important, the irreducible core, is Jesus Christ himself. And maybe like that man, you'd say, "I don't know, but I was blind, and now I see." If you admit blindness, and you admit that it's only Jesus who's touched you, that's a testimony. If your testimony is, "Well, I've always been a Christian. I've been raised religiously. Well, I've known a lot more about God than before you did, you young whippersnappers," then you remain in your blindness. As long as you fail to admit the need, the touch of Jesus Christ, you remain blind. Salvation, and we testify that every time we have communion, is simply the testimony of, "I was blind, but Jesus touched me and now I see." It first started when we admitted that we couldn't see. Any man to be saved must first be a humble man. He must bow before God. He can't be puffed up and prideful. He has to say, "Oh, I need your grace, O Lord. I'm a sinner. I need you to touch me and save me and cleanse me, heal me." A person who doesn't admit that never asks God for forgiveness. And so the first step is always the admission of sin. The second step is the asking of the Lord to cleanse you from sin and to receive His Son as payment for your sin.